Hello, this is a trimmed down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. Maybe the first track they ever heard, the first track they may have brought, several tracks that mark moments in their life, as well as one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is Jonathan Huxley, who is a very successful British contemporary artist who is also visually impaired. In Jonathan's Tracks of My Life, we will go on a journey from his early teenage school days in the 70s and 80s at a school for visually impaired people in Coventry. Jonathan was the first student from the school to study art, firstly at Berkshire College of Art, before studying fine art at Nottingham Trent Polytechnic and then at the Royal Academy of Art in London. We will then move from London to New York during the early 1990s, as Jonathan made a name for himself as a club visual artist, firstly in London and then in New York, including artwork for Grace Jones' birthday party at the infamous Tunnel Club. Jonathan then shares memories of watching old Western movies with his dad and how the genre has both influenced and appeared in some of his work. Finally, Jonathan reflects on the strong relationship he has with his partner, Jane, and how he has also shared some of his life experiences with his teenage son. Hello, Jonathan, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Glad to be here, Toby. Nice to be talking to you again.
Brilliant stuff. So how did you find it selecting your tracks?
As everybody says, it's impossible, isn't it? It's ridiculously difficult, but luxurious process, which took me, I suppose, about 4 weeks. I'm an avid record collector, well, music on all formats now, hundreds of albums and bits and pieces, which I like to consider a very cool, eclectic collection, you know. So I thought, oh, it'd be great. I can really show off here and play some really, really, really interesting stuff. But then, of course, the remit being Tracks of My Life, it means that, you know, it should relate to significant moments and events in your life, which I quickly realized led to some fairly, not necessarily corny choices, but, you know, slightly sort of tracks that might be more obvious than I might choose if I was DJing, for example, you know. Some things that you just think, oh, really, really, do I have to tell the world that that's my thing? But yeah, you know, there are points where it's just unavoidable because they were so important at various stages, particularly when one was very young.
And your first track, Jonathan, takes you back to school at the age of 14 and hearing Message in a Bottle by the Police through the senior common room doors.
Yeah, you see my case exactly. No. I stand by the Police. I think the Police was fantastic. But yes, I was 14 years old. I have actually quite recently discovered a study that suggests that the music you listen to around about that age, 14, 15, particularly for boys, has the most profound effect on you. And yeah, it would have been a brilliant evening, sort of knocking around school, trying to find something to do and hanging around the senior common room door, trying to get in, but you couldn't because you had to be 16. and this music came out, wafted through the door. And I remember rushing and pressing my ear firmly to the door and hearing, you know, that Andy Summers guitar riff in Message in a Bottle, and then that squeaky sort of voice, and thinking, this is extraordinary. What on earth is that? Never heard anything like it. It was absolutely captivating, and it propelled me to go and get a guitar very shortly after that, and possibly wrongly advised form a band at school.
Because that sound of the Police was so iconic at the time, you know, as you say, with Andy Summers' guitars, Stuart Copeland's drumming, Sting's bass line and everything else. And it must have, as you say, struck a chord with you back then.
Yeah, no, it was perfect. I mean, Copeland's drumming was like nobody else's. And to get nerdy, I remember going to a music shop in Coventry and saying, I want to sound like Andy Summers. How do I do that? And the guy said, well, you're going to need a flanger and a compressor. Here you go. Hook this up. And it was like, oh, my God, I sound like Andy Summers, only a lot worse. Yeah, it was exciting, very exciting. And the look as well, of course, you know, being an albino, I had the ready-made sort of bleached hair. Just had to spike it up a bit, police my hair up and get myself a stripy T-shirt. And I was off, you know, that was a kind of, that was my first sort of, well, it wasn't actually, no, I'd been a younger punk, but yeah, it was an identity I liked in many ways. I'll send an SOS to the world. I'll send an SOS to the world. I hope that someone gets mad. I hope that someone gets mad. I hope that someone gets my message in a bottle, yeah. Message in a bottle. Message in the bottle there by The Police, and that early sound of The Police, I think, to me, certainly sounds incredibly fresh today. Jonathan, for your next track, we come to another band with a fantastic, great drummer. It's Rush and obviously Neil Peart. And I wondered why you've chosen this particular track, because I think you say that being a sort of punk back then, Rush was a bit of a guilty pleasure for you?
Absolutely. This is another one where I thought, oh God, I'm going to have to put Rush in, because they had such a profound effect on me when I heard the Spirit of Radio was the track that everybody heard on the radio back then, which would have been, what, 81, 82, something like that. And then I went and bought that album, Permanent Waves, I think. It was just a fantastic sound. Again, like nothing I'd ever heard, but it wasn't punk. And punk was... it's quite a fascist movement, really. I mean, you were only supposed to listen to bands that didn't know how to play their instruments, whereas Rush could clearly more than just play their instruments. I mean, you know, sort of a band that could change time, signature and key five times in a song with extraordinary energy, but without being pretentious. But it was just complex and just virtuosic performances and thunderous drumming, as you say. Neil Peart, we recently died. So it's nice to have a little tribute to the professor, as he was known, the drummer of Rush. And the track that I've chosen, Red Barchetta, I suppose it's also for my son, because he's become a Rush fan as well. I don't know what I've done that to him. But he's become a fan. And Red Barchetta is a great story about youthful exuberance. It's about a lad who goes to visit his grandfather beyond the wire out in the middle of the countryside, the mountains, probably outside Toronto, in the head of Neil Peart, who wrote the lyrics. And he goes to visit his grandfather, and his grandfather dusts off and gives him this old sports car, this Red Barchetta car. And off he goes into the mountain roads and has this race with all sorts of strange other vehicles that probably hark back from the past, goes into another world completely. And it's full of, you know, risk and speed and everything a young man wants. And then he comes back having escaped all the dangers out there, and comes back and sits by his grandfather at the fireside and carries on telling the stories. Rush's songs are always very wholesome, but this one's, you know, it's about being a boy and all the excitement and the expectation that comes with that.
Red Barchetta by Rush there, and if I could play the drums like Neil Peart, I would be. I remember.
Well, we do know a lad who could. Yeah. He was at school with us, one Noel Thatcher. My Mr. Noel Thatcher was pretty good at it.
For your next track, Jonathan, we come to theme music from a Western film, and I think something of an imagery that inspired you a little bit and has come into your artwork. What is it about the Westerns that you love and the sort of style of them and the themes that come into Westerns? Why is it so important to you?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The Western theme has featured in my work over several years, maybe decades, actually. In fact, I did a series of paintings called Manifest Destiny, parts 1 to 5. Manifest Destiny being the policy, was it Abraham Lincoln? I don't know. One of those presidents who suggested that it was manifest destiny of the settlers to move west, claim the land at all costs, which is a pretty dark idea, really, because that meant they had free reign to, you know, attack and kill off all the native indigenous people there and claim the land as their own. As the guy from Beta Band said, the Western says it's a lie. The way that the what's that one? How the West was won.
Yes.
It's a lie, but it's made to sound like fun. So assuaging all that, I, as a young lad, loved the drama and the stylized violence where nobody seemed to really get hurt, but they just fly in the air and you get those fantastic ricochets off rocks and these incredibly sort of dramatic, almost Greek tragedy setups of the shootout and the gunfight at the end, particularly in the film that this music is from that we're going to hear, which is the middle of the three films of the Spaghetti Western trilogy, the Clint Eastwood trilogy, A Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, of course.
Mm.
But my favourite by far of all three of them is for a Few Dollars More, which is an extraordinary story. You start off with Lee Van Cleef and Clint Eastwood, both playing bounty hunters, both arrive in the same small town, and they're both after the same, what's essentially a serial killer, gunslinger, another word for a serial killer, really, some psychopath called Indio. And they tussle with each other. As the film goes on, you discover that Lee Van Cleef's motivations, he's the colonel, are very different to Eastwood. Eastwood just wants the money, whereas the colonel is there to avenge the death of his sister, who was raped and murdered by Indio. That they were twins, and both of them carried a locket with each other's pictures in. And when the locket opens, it plays a certain tune on a sort of a music box chime. But the one that Indio keeps, which belonged to Colonel's sister, is damaged in the murder, and it doesn't end properly. It ends on an unresolved note. He uses this in every gunfight to say to his opponent, when the music stops, we shoot. And of course, he knows that the music doesn't stop when you think it's going to stop. Anyway, so moving to the end, the huge, big shootout at the end, where Indio has the colonel prisoned without any weapon. He's going to kill him. He walks in with the damaged locket playing this music. And then out of nowhere, of course, Eastwood appears with a shotgun pointed at Indio's head, throws the colonel another gun, and he's got the colonel's locket. The colonel goes to his pocket and realises it's gone. And of course, this one ends on the right note. It's a resolve note. And everything is resolved. Of course, the colonel kills the psychopath and everybody is sort of happy at the end. But I just loved, since a kid, watching them with my old man, my dad, on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon. He'd fall asleep and I'd get to watch whatever the Western was. And for some reason, the television regulations seemed to be lax then. So I got to watch all sorts of incredibly violent and exciting Westerns. It's the theatre. Total theatre. It's amazing.
Have you watched Westerns with your own son now or not?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. He's watched the film that we're just talking about, the one that this music is from, Carillion's theme. He's watched it and actually loved it. I think possibly for all the same reasons as I do.
But what's Triumph from the film A Few Dollars More? Jonathan, for your next track, we move to a change in your life and perhaps a determination for you when you left school and wanted to go to art school. And I think at the time your teachers were against it and your dad wasn't particularly that impressed about it. What was going through your mind at that time and why were you so determined to go to art school?
It's hard to spot the moment when I made that decision, because talking to my son just this week, he said, "I don't know what I want to do, Dad. I'm really worried what I'm going to do after school." I said, "Jules, you're 13 years old. Don't worry about it. Just, you know, enjoy your childhood." So going back to when I was 12, 13, the last thing I thought about was being an artist. I did some drawings. I knew I liked a bit of drawing, but I'd do the drawing and then walk away and then probably go and ride a skateboard or something. You know, I suppose most of my time then I spent trying to sort of blend in and not be eccentric or do anything different. It was enough being an albino in the 1970s when everybody else had long brown hair and beards, and that was just the women, you know. and I was bullied pretty mercilessly through the 70s in mainstream school for my appearance. And last thing I wanted to think about was doing something as eccentric and esoteric as being an artist. So that I went through school, you know, liking art more and more as the years went by, and then I think probably around about the time we did our O-levels, I discovered that you could go to college and study this, just art, which seemed extraordinary. We went to quite an academic school, and you were expected to go and do your A-levels if you were at that, if you were fortunate enough to be, you know, at that level of education, and go to do something, you know, that would give you a proper fitting job at the end of it, you know, things like being, you know, lawyer, doctor, whatever. So I suppose it was the responsibility of my teachers to say to me, "Look, don't do that. You can't do that. Nobody makes a living at this." And so I was being dissuaded quite enthusiastically. And my father went nuts. I mean, my father was a mechanic and made very, very well and became a haulage contractor and did various other things. And I think he just listened to me and thought, "Who is this kid? Who is this? I don't understand." He went nuts. And of course, that was just grist to the mill for me. I was a bit fairly stubborn. And suddenly it just occurred to me, what is this place that incurs so much opposition from people in authority over me? And I thought, well, it's got to be fantastic, hasn't it? It's got to be great. That's where I'm going to go. I don't know anything else about it, but I'm going there. So I remember the art teacher, Robert Stanier, he said famously to me, he said, "Well, Huxley, you're not driving a Ferrari, but you appear to have the petrol. So I suppose we better find out how to do this," because I was the first person from school to go to art school, to even to apply. And I remember the process was to go for an interview with a folder of your work and talk about your work, and then you would get accepted or not. And I was very lucky to get accepted to my first course, which was a foundation course at Berkshire College of Art and Fashion, which was an old Victorian school with an added on sort of mizzen hut for the foundation. Tiny, with very little facilities. But the point was, they sent me a letter saying, "You have an unconditional offer to go to study foundation in art." Well, it was all my contemporaries at school were trying, sweating away that summer to get their two B's and an A to go to a red brick university to do a 3-year solid degree. So I pretty much flunked my A-levels because I'd got my unconditional offer before we sat them, you know. So I dismal results, spent all my time in the art room then. And I went home for the summer holidays, another blazing row with my father. So I left home the day after I left school and went straight to Maidenhead, where the college was, and I would start in September. And I got myself a place to live and I got myself a job. The place to live was a bedsit in a damp, two up, two down Victorian house converted into 8 bedrooms. The kitchen was a greasy cooker and fridge on the landing. I discovered actually years later that was not unusual. And the job was working on the dustbins, doing a dustbin cart round. So I went to the job centre and got that job, and they said, "Oh yeah, it's great, you'll be finished by 12 o'clock, start at 5:30, you're done." I was shattered every day. So real culture shock from leaving this privileged, you know, cosseted boarding school. And I came with me
with a pile full of, I don't know, top 20 tapes, the old tape cassettes, and I had a Sony tape radio tape player that I'd won actually in a dental poster competition, and I had this album with me, and Elvis with this track on by Elvis Costello. I've always loved Elvis Costello. I've got pretty much all his albums. If I'm a completist, it's probably nearest would be Elvis Costello. A bit like the Police, but more so. He had that razor-edged voice, amazing, ragged guitar, thunderous drums of Pete Harris, I can't remember his name. It was just urgent and gritty. But this song is a little bit lesser known of his work. It's more of a ballad, and it's in huge production and quite tragic. And it's called A Man Out of Time. And it sort of reminded me of my dad at the time. He came from another world, and he was quite old when he had me, and he had certain values that we fought off. But so that's why this is included.
Where it came to hide when it ran from you.
Man Out of Time there by Elvis Costello and The Attractions. Now we move to the early 2000s with your next track, with the Groove Armada track. But I think it also takes you back to a time in the 90s when you were working and dancing in clubs and working with ultraviolet light installations. And I think it took you to New York and working on Grace Jones' birthday party at the famous Tunnel Club. But I wondered, what was the ultraviolet light installation? Why did you start working in that medium? And how has it sort of, I suppose, come into the rest of your artwork?
When I left the Royal Academy in 1992, I'd had, 7 years of rigorous art education, where I'd spent most of my time drawing from the life model, drawing observationally, learning my craft. And then I set about dismantling all that, breaking all the rules, and frankly, living a little. I did very well when I left the academy. I sold a lot of work and made quite a lot of money, and various opportunities were laid in front of me. And I started sort of having my teenage years that I hadn't had through school, because that was quite disciplined, as you know. It all sort of happened from the early 90s, as it did for so many other people. We all sort of hit the ground running. I had money in my pocket. London was wide open to me with all the bars and the clubs and the nightlife, and I sort of swallowed it whole. And being obsessed with music as well, it sort of all came to this perfect storm. And I started to do artwork for the night, for in nightclubs, and ultraviolet was something I'd seen other people use, and I thought, this has got extraordinary potential, and started to set about using that. And as you say, developed a small reputation for doing work in dance venues, as we now call them, and that took me out to New York. I was given a commission to do a painting for the boardroom of a record company. The record company was called Imago Records. Not so well known, but it was owned by a guy called Terry Ellis, who had sold his shares in Chrysalis Records, which is a much bigger concern. More people would know that one. So they gave me a fantastic deal. I was paid for the painting. They got me a studio on Upper Broadway. I was living in Harlem. That's another story. I'd been there a couple of years before and met some friends. So I was living in the black part of Harlem, which is fascinating. What happened was I had photographs of various club installations I'd done in London that had been taken by a photographer in The Guardian, a Guardian photographer, a guy called Barry Weezer. And he'd given me colour versions of these, because at the time The Guardian was going to come out as a colour newspaper. I don't know if you remember Eddie Shah's Today paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, The Guardian was going to, there was the only broadsheet that was colour. Didn't last very long, but The Guardian thought about doing it. So they were doing some experimental colour prints. And anyway, so I went out to New York armed with these fantastic photographs of stuff I'd done in London. Went around the clubs in New York hawking for business while doing the painting for the record company, which was an easy job, really. And I was getting knocked back. And I mean, New York's quite a hard town to to make an impression. And after about a week of this, I thought, my voice was going, you know, walking around clubs trying to talk to people. I thought, forget about it. I'm going to go to the biggest place I know. And if I don't get anywhere, I'll stop. So I went to a place called the Tunnel Club. The Tunnel Club was so cool because it was built in an old subway station. And I met the floor manager and he said, no, you've got to be kidding. We've had everything done. There's nothing for you to do. And then he saw this guy coming out of a side door. And he said, oh, you can always ask that guy over there. Pointing to this guy coming out of a door who was wearing a double-breasted suit, a huge kipper tie. He had his hair slicked back like Gordon Gekko in Wall Street. And to top it off, a huge fat cigar and an eye patch. All right. This guy I later discovered was Peter Gation, who was the owner of the five biggest clubs in New York. And I remember going up to him with my photograph, looking a bit worn out and sad by now, and just putting it in his face because of my voice was just... And he took the photograph and he sucked on his cigar and said, you do this, come to my office in the morning. Gave me his card. And I went there in the morning and... I was introduced to various other people that worked for him, one guy called Michael Alleg, and they put me on the payroll, and I ended up being invited to do the visuals for Grace Jones's birthday party at the Tunnel Club. That was sort of enough for me. I'd experienced the high point of the nightlife, but it was an extraordinary experience. So this track, I thought we'd better have something from this millennium. So far, it's been very 80s driven. And this track, so it's great. It's got a bit of everything that I loved when I was going out in those days. It's got house music beat to it. It's got a bit of a reggae thing, a bit of a drum and bass thing. It's a great, great stomping dance tune, as they used to say. They still do.
Enter in the dance, plug it in and we begin. Crowd up in the center, they watch pretty with him. Watch the way we drop it in a mix time it. Rise and amplify it when we come in with the swing. Just follow in the back and naturally harmonize it. Climb into position, we synchronize it. Live from outer ghetto, we maximize it. Sound of the Groove Armada, we super.
The classic sound of Groove Armada with super styling there. Jonathan, your next track is dedicated to your partner, Jane. And I think you and Jane are probably very similar characters, and you say you've been through a lot of stuff together. And I wondered sort of how you first met and sort of how you've been able to stay together for so long.
Well, we've been together, I guess, about 10 years now. We met years and years ago when we shared a studio and I was sort of gadding about town at night and stuff. And we were friends. Jane said, you can back off. You're mostly just trouble. And then we didn't see each other for a good few years. I'd been married and I'd made a bit of a mess of that. Coming out the other side, and I got a phone call in the studio and it was Jane. I hadn't seen her for about eight years or something, maybe 10. And she'd had a few problems of her own, and we got together. It's a very good friendship. We get on really, really well. We don't live together, but we're very, very close. She's had a tough couple of years. She's just got over a fairly serious cancer. So she deserves a dedication. And I kind of gave her this song a few years ago. It's the romantic side of me. I can be a bit of a softie. It's James Taylor, Something in the Way She Moves. So it's for her. And of course, sweet baby James. Boy, can he play a guitar.
There's something in the way she moves, or looks my way, or calls my name, that seems to leave this troubled world behind.
James Taylor there, and Something in the Way She Moves, which is, as you say, dedicated to your partner, Jane. Now, Jonathan, we come to that final track that you would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. And it's one which I think you were introduced to at the age of 4 and one that you've introduced to your son. What is the track? Actually, you'd probably say tracks. And why have you chosen them?
Okay, so this is Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. I was given the vinyl, which I think had only been out a year or two, if that, when I would have been 4 or 5 years old, and I was given this as a present. And I played it, as they say, until the needle wore it out. It's just, Benjamin Britten takes a theme by Purcell, and he uses it to break down the orchestra, first into the orchestral part, so, you know, the brass, the woodwind, the strings, the percussion, the four parts. And then he then breaks it further down into each individual instrument. And then it builds and builds into a fantastic crescendo at the end. And, you know, it's a fantastic educational tune. But the Purcell theme is just so infectious. It's beautiful. And it can be light and jolly and tragic. In fact, the last 2 minutes, which you may hear, something happens at the end where the whole orchestra reaches chaos, a cacophonous chaos, and then he brings it all back together. You bring the theme back together, and then at some point the brass rises up and it soars like a cry, and I will weep, guaranteed, every single time. It's a certain thing that happens to me if I say play certain tunes. I've demonstrated this to Jules with other pieces. It will guarantee to make the waterworks start. Fine piece of music, and I think it's got everything. I'd hand it down to anybody, and I'd recommend it.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's been absolutely brilliant, Toby. Thanks ever so much for having me.